Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real.
4, 3, 2, and 1.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and alongside us today, folks, we got a Real Leaders Impact Award winner here today, a Unite attendee. Please give a warm welcome to Miss Kelly Ann Winget, the founder and CEO of Alternative Wealth Partners and also the author of Pitch the Bitch, Grab Your Financial Future by the Bags. Kelly, thanks for coming on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Now, we were talking a little bit before the show, and I really just want to kind of start here to really grab anyone's interest who's coming on this show. And a lot of people here listening to the program, Kelly, they're in the impact space, or they're learning how to like get into their impact journey. Now, you kind of have a bit of a contrarian approach to what impact means. First and foremost, what do you think it means in a general sense, and how is your approach a little bit different?
I think that as impact leaders, we all just want to make the world a little bit better. I mean, we want to leave the place better than we found it, I think is everyone's mission. And I think just leaning into your individual lived experience makes you, you know, capable of having an impact, whether directly inside of a small community or on a global scale. And there's some leaders that step into that responsibility of taking their lived experience in a big way compared to people that are just kind of doing the work inside their communities.
I like that, and certainly can agree with it too. I mean, it's easy to make decisions by advice, but if you can actually make decisions based on your experience, you know, no one can really argue with that. So tell me a little bit more about this contrarian approach, though. You make a little bit, I guess you have a different philosophy on in terms of how to make an impact and an investment. How do you do that?
Right. There's a lot of focus now that we shift away from, is it ESG? Is it impact? You know, is it DEI? There's a lot of controversy around what that means. And I think there's a lot of focus on how do we get more money into the hands of diverse and female founded companies. And so you have these funds. I'm in the fund space, right? So we're asset allocators. We push money into things. And there's not enough focus from my point of view on creating the pipeline of investors that can invest in those diverse founders. Because the reality is that if you have an all white male investment committee, they're never going to be able to look at a women's healthcare company in a way that makes sense to them to fund, right? They're like, well, it's too niche. Well, women are half the population, so I'm not really sure how that's a niche market, right? So if we need to create diversity from the people that are managing the money, investing the money, it's actually why I wrote the book, right? Women have been pretty much exclusively removed from the conversation when it comes to investing, and I want to change that. So my focus is on creating that pipeline of women and diverse investors so that women and diverse fund and founders get funded.
Makes a lot of sense. And I would love for you to share the example you just shared with me with the ammo in this case, because I think it's very unique. I think it's something that's kind of refreshing to hear. Tell me a little bit more about this recent acquisition with the ammo company.
Yeah. So I'm heavily invested in pretty male dominated spaces, energy infrastructure, manufacturing. I'm 5 generations in oil and gas. So there's just like things that I like that most women and diverse people aren't looking at because they just weren't involved in those types of businesses. And so I look at a industry like manufacturing and say, you know, there needs to be some representation there so that solutions are being built that aren't thought of before. We acquired an ammunition component manufacturer. So it makes a component of ammunition. And now it's the only woman-owned manufacturing of ammunition in the world. And that's just because I'm a woman and I put money into it. And so that's how I feel like we're changing the industry, because if we can't find someone that exists in that space already, we just become it.
That's really interesting. And like, what do you think the difference is in terms of a management style or approach?
I think, well, from my experience, for me, I think I'm just a little bit crazy, but I think we just bring in like a new point of view, right? We're looking at different things that might be problems than people who look at an industry the same way that it has always been. When you're talking about manufacturing, especially like bullets, right? You're talking about something that's been made the same way since the beginning of time. So there's been literally no innovation in that space. And that's kind of typical for most manufacturing and infrastructure and kind of energy things. Oil and gas has really been done the same way forever and ever and ever. There's some technology advancement, right? But if you look at any oil and gas company today, they still have one geologist, one engineer, but now they have like 50 accountants. It's all about how cheap can we get it out of the ground instead of how like safe or, you know, environmentally conscious can we get it out of the ground? It's how cheap we can get it. So that's kind of the innovation that's happening. Instead of having someone come in and be like, hey, if we actually do this, that, and the other thing, and think about the impact it's having on the environment and the communities around that space, we'll actually make more money because we're helping more people with what we're doing and how we're doing it.
Got it. So if I'm gathering that right, are you suggesting that with a more female-led approach, the decisions that you make are going to factor in more maybe long-term decisions focused on, you know, its impact on the environment, on the climate, on the people, on the community? Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. And I think that the stats kind of show that of a result of how much money women are reinvesting in their community compared to their male counterparts. Not necessarily a bad thing, but our focus is mainly how can we redistribute that back into the world in an appropriate way, instead of how can we collect more dollars for our own selves.
Right. And as an investor, like if someone were to come and pitch to you and have that same pitch, you know, I'm going to be a leader that's going to focus more on, you know, the environmental impact and on the longevity and the health and the well-being of the employees that are making this ammo, for instance. And we're maybe going to use that money and do away with the accountants. How does that land on you from an investment lens? And how can someone combat something like that?
I really focus on creating the bridge between the people that are really focused on how can I profit from my investment and how can I generate impact from my investment, because I don't think that you have to forfeit one for the other. I think that if you holistically invest in anything with both of those things in mind, that you will come out on top. It's a big part of what I do is bridging those two kind of personality types, because there's a lot of money in ammo. We could sit there and just profiteer for the rest of our lives on it, or those profits can be reinvested to support de-escalation training, gun safety, lobbying for stronger, stricter gun laws, which seems counterintuitive. But if you have more responsible gun owners, you're going to have people that are buying ammunition from you just because it's mission-based, right? And you're still going to make money. There's a ton of margin there.
It's interesting you brought up an example with like a manufacturer, because I mean, it's very accurate and very right. I mean, things have been, especially the companies at scale, they've been made the same way for a long period of time. But really, where I've been noticing a lot of the impact innovation in the impact space rather has been in the supply chain. Why though? It's opaque. I think a lot of people don't really understand kind of what's going on. But let me just give you a quick example. I want to just pick your brain on this. It appears to me that a major challenge any startup is having is when they become a threat, when they gain some market share, the larger companies that are, you know, a lot of the larger companies have a lot of influence on the same suppliers that they have. And so what they'll do is, you know, they'll either come to buy out the business, or if they don't buy out the business, they'll buy out the suppliers or encourage them or maybe even threaten them to not, you know, supply this organization. So what I'm noticing in the impact space is a lot of impact companies are innovating and building their own reusable, recyclable supply chains that they can't touch. Are you noticing something like that in the gun manufacturing space, whether it's, you know, whatever the lead or the metal is? Are you noticing anything like that in terms of impact innovation? That's just my question.
Yeah, there's a lot of competition, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And that's across all industries, I think. And we see that from some of the other projects that we're working on, where there's this high demand from another manufacturer's customers to bring their entire assembly line back domestically. So they put them on a deadline. They're like, we're going to stop using you if you don't bring back your manufacturing to the United States. And there's a lot of that pressure coming industry-wide in everything. And especially when it comes to things like ammunition, there's a lot of competition, and there could be somebody that's bigger that says, you know what, we don't want to compete and we're just going to cut them off at the legs, right? It's really important that we spend the time and the money to build resources. It doesn't matter if it's domestically. I prefer that, and that's how we invest, because of that very issue. I don't want companies that are trying to do good things in the world to be cut off at the legs. So innovating and investing in supply chain and resources here that have aligned missions is really important. And I think that that's changing, and people are kind of putting their foot down, which is also a really great thing about female founders, is because they kind of say, too bad, we had to bootstrap anyways, so I don't need to take your money, and I'm going to do it the right way with or without you.
So that's interesting. And so your philosophy then on, you know, it's maximizing stakeholder value, how do you like to work with the suppliers you just mentioned, bringing back local? Anything that you could provide from your experience for someone listening to this being like, hey, this is really interesting to me. I'd love to do it in my company.
I think that it's just having a relationship and a conversation with either your existing supply chain or friends in the industry, right? I think one thing that AI will never replace is those relationships. And so relationships are super important in businesses. One of our other portfolio companies is a gender diverse clothing company called Dapper Boy. They have a really, really good relationship with their manufacturers. They were struggling to get inventory over here. And so I said, you just need to reach out and talk to them and like tell them what you're going through and ask them what solutions they're able to do. Because a lot of these manufacturers own their own supply chain. And so if you have a really good relationship with them, they're willing to work with you. I think that that's the big takeaway, is like companies want to do business. So they were able to negotiate really, really friendly shipping terms and funding terms. And so now they've in a completely different situation as far as funding their inventory.
That's interesting. Now, you know, the quintessential example of like, hey, here's alternative energy, but is it good for the planet and the world? In my mind is like solar, right? Mm-hmm. It's like most of the solar panels that I'm aware of, especially US solar panel companies, they're manufactured in China, mm-hmm. and in poor labor areas. And even, I think you were at the event, the CEO even is admitting this, right? He's like, what's better? Better solar or labor conditions? What are your thoughts on that in terms of alternative energy? I mean, you grew up in oil and gas. What have you seen in this industry, and what are your thoughts on maybe what's best for the world?
Well, it's definitely going to be a time and capital intensive transition. And oil and gas has been around for 200 years, and there's nowhere in sight where that oil and gas is going anywhere. But you have to partner with the existing infrastructure in order to fund the future, right? I don't think that oil and gas is end all be all. I'm five generations into this, and there's no reason why we should still be drilling the way that we're drilling. And there should be transition work being done. The problem is that even as consumers, like, we have to take a look at ourselves in the mirror and realize we are power hungry, crazy people, and we won't stop using power. Like, AI is going to make this infinitely worse, because you're talking about the type of computing power needed to power these models and all of the solutions that are being built around that technology, right? Oil and gas alone cannot do that. And so partnering with them, funneling the way that we do it, kind of Robin Hood, we invest in oil and gas, we use the dividends from oil and gas to fund alternative energy investments. So we leverage all of that together. those fields will eventually need to be transitioned out of oil and gas. There's not really anything you can do on that property with the exception of putting solar panels on them, because you can't do anything with the soil, right? Can't do anything. It's out in the middle of nowhere usually. But the real big issue with solar in general is the battery storage, right? Storing power is our biggest problem with creating the infrastructure change. Oil and gas is still cheaper than anything else. And we have to use it when it's cheapest, right? We're still at $80 a barrel. That's really expensive. Oil needs to come back down to $45, $55 a barrel in order to make it make sense to build the infrastructure to support solar, wind, or whatever. Solar only makes sense at $130 a barrel. People don't think about that. It has to be really, you have to fund it now, even if we don't necessarily use it today.
I think it's a hot take, and I think it's a really, really wise take too. I mean, I think you're spot on with that kind of take in terms of the transition that needs to actually take place if we want to make a change. But thinking even like long term, I mean, you've been in the oil and gas industry, you said five generations. At the time, I'm sure, you know, five generations ago, it was the clean energy, right? Coal was the dirty energy they were trying to say. Now it's solar. There will come a point in time, though, don't you think, when solar is maybe a dirty energy?
Well, you have to think about the waste that's created in solar, too. Like you mentioned, the solar panels made overseas. What kind of carbon footprint does that have? The reality is that everything that you touch involves petroleum, involves a barrel of oil, whether it's a solar panel or not. And we have to make that process cleaner, even the waste from that. And I'm in Texas, okay? If you drive west through Texas, going west, you'll find a windmill graveyard, okay? It's just a bunch of like trashed pieces of windmill in a field. And half the windmills don't work. Like, that's a problem. And it's one of those things you have to focus on, because there's a lot of waste in that space. And that's really what the focus should be on as we transition, is how do you make that less wasteful and make more sense? In my personal opinion, I think that natural gas is our clean transition away from true fossil fuels, because it is renewable. Technically, it can renew itself, but it's in mass quantities, it's super cheap, and it can power anything. So that's what we should be using to transition away from fossil fuels into a more sustainable energy resource.
A lot of investors think the same thing too. There's no doubt about that. That or even nuclear going long, long term. Interesting with the wind turbines, you know, not being there anymore. I guess the former windmills, now the wind turbines. I'm just like a little bit more curious too, in like terms of the metrics that you'll use when you're speaking with investors. I think 40% of the industry can actually agree on ESG metrics. Of course, 99% of them will agree on financials in order to get a loan. There's regulation right now in the EU that states, you know, you must disclose your carbon emissions. Do you see that coming to the United States?
Not for a long time. I think that we try not to create too many barriers between the people that are putting money around and like innovation. I mean, we're in election year, so it could be, who knows?
Yeah.
There's one direction in which that would never come to the United States, and there's one direction that might push it out a few years. I think that we try to do things in a sustainable way, especially when it comes to regulation. And I think America really tries to set the precedent on like how this should be done sustainably.
Right. Yeah. No, it's just interesting. Man, obviously, there's a lot of class actions going on about it right now. I was just kind of curious to get your take. I mean, in terms of metrics, though, like, are you like focused on disclosure? Like, do you measure your carbon emissions? Is that even of interest?
No, because we invest in oil. So, I mean, there's it's very hard to record and track. And I think there's companies out there that are focused on that reporting, especially from the fund management side. How much impact is your portfolio making from an ESG, from an impact perspective? And as that data gets better, I think we'll have better reporting on that. But I think today it's not, I mean, it's self-reporting. So I could tell them I'm great, you know, and that's what they would report.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, anyway, I was just curious about that, because it seems to be that, you know, this is coming and that it's inevitable, but you know, who knows? just out of curiosity, the book, Pitch the Bitch.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about, you know, what inspired you to write the initial book.
So people are kind of taken back by the title. It's behind me. But in the movie, The Boiler Room, and like one of the first scenes, it has like the brand new broker coming in. He's getting trained by the old guy. And the old guy's like, the first rule of brokering or whatever is don't pitch the bitch. Like if you get a woman on the phone, you just hang up because it's like a waste of your time. Call you if the stock's up, she'll call you if the stock's down. You know, it's just like they're the worst customer. And that kind of messaging has kind of been woven through pop culture and everything as far as from women's perspective, like everything we've been taught about money and investing. And so it finally got to a point in my career where I was like, you know, that this type of messaging around women and money, like, doesn't make any sense to me, because I would spend a lot of time working with male investors and it would get to the point where they would want to make an investment decision. And they're like, I don't know which bank account to use. I don't know where the checkbook's at, you know, whatever. I'm like, oh, I need to talk to my wife. And it's like, well, why didn't you include your wife 2 weeks ago when we first started talking about this? And so then the wife's upset because she doesn't know what's going on. And, you know, she's getting brought into the decision at the last minute. And this was about halfway through my career where I was like, I'm no longer having conversations without both parties involved. And I'm not going to exclude somebody from the conversation about investing, even if they are a BIPOC person, a woman, it doesn't matter. And to me, like, that's my focus. I think that anyone has the ability to make this type of investment, and it's their responsibility to become accredited or not. And I think that that's what sets us apart. We're able to have a majority of our limited partners be women or diverse people compared to a lot of my colleagues.
And just out of curiosity, like, what is the process to become an accredited investor for anyone that's curious?
Yeah, so you're going to have an income over $200,000 or a net worth over $1 million. Now, I think that the SEC is going to probably increase that, because $1 million today is not what $1 million meant 15 years ago. So most of the time, our investors have over $5 million net worths that work with us. But if you can get over that $200,000, $250,000 income, that'll make you an accredited investor.
And just like, you know, you're at the event, you know, we're with Damon and everyone on stage, and we're talking about pitching. Like, to you and your experience of pitching, of course, you have to raise funds. You know, what makes a good pitch?
I think that when we're listening to pitches or receiving pitches from potential portfolio companies, I really focus on the person, because that person is not going to be just a one-time business owner, right? As entrepreneurs, most of the audience, probably everybody that was in the room at the Real Unite event, like, those are people who are going to run businesses till the day that they die, right? We are entrepreneurs through and through. And that's really what I look for. I think that they have to really believe what they have built. I have worked with a lot of founders who, you know, were either pulled into it. They have co-founders that they had to find after they started a business, and it changed the entire model of the entire thing. And so I really want to focus on the person whose original idea it was, and if they're going to be, you know, project number one, right? I want them to be in project 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 forever, as far as our relationship is involved, because we're investors. We're going to be attached to this person for somewhere between 5 and 10 years. So it's really important for me to, like, really understand that person I'm about to give money to.
That's definitely important. And, like, so what are those qualities then? I mean, you just mentioned a few. Obviously, they got to be in for the long term. And I'm sure you could sift by asking a few questions. But, like, what are some of those qualities you're looking for?
People that have patience, are calm and kind of level-headed during times of crisis, because as business owners, we all know that we have moments that where things are insane. And how do you handle that kind of pressure, one, internally, but also externally? You know, like, what's your personal life dynamic? And how can that affect your business dynamic? And also, like, your sense of responsibility to the investors. Like, are you treating every moment as something that you're going to be affected by? Or is it always just like, oh, well, it's investors' money, right? Hmm. Or it's bank's money or whatever. Or have you internalized that?
And I
I
mean,
spend
at that,
a lot of time working with people's personalities before I make an investment.
I mean, that's something we look for in employees too, right? I mean, it is an ownership mindset that, you know, great people have to have at the end of the day. What's been your experience with having kind of like an ownership mindset? I mean, have you always, I mean, kind of in the family business, but like, tell me about your experience with developing this ownership mindset.
I think that it helped to have two parents that were in the financial industry, but also entrepreneurs. My mother always worked in the private sector. My father owned a couple of businesses before going to Price Waterhouse. And so we, internally in our home, you know, money and risk taking was never a subject off the table. And so we were allowed to be independent about our, you know, achievements and things we were taking on from an early age. So I'm very fortunate in that. I think that had a lot to do with what I'm doing now. For parents that are listening to this, I think it's important to know that if you can't financially support your children, but giving them an emotional safety net to try things and fail without, you know, a lot of worry and stress of not having somewhere to fall on that's soft, is really important. I was allowed to fail a lot coming, like growing up, that, and it was okay to fail. It wasn't like devastating. So now I can take risk without, you know, too much worry about failing to a point where it's detrimental to everyone.
And when you think about kind of where you are today, are there some things, whether it's in your prior history, your background, world experiences that maybe have led you to pursue this career?
I worked for a lot of people for 10 years, telling other people's stories, telling other people's dreams to investors, and then working with investors on how to find those dreamers in the world. Eventually ended up in a family office, a large family office, and there was just a disconnect between that amount of money and the retail investor base, like a normal person. And I didn't want to serve people that detached from reality.
Mm.
I think that there's a lot of good about family offices and the way that they're set up. And a lot of family offices are doing really good things in the world. And I want more people to have that experience. So even if somebody doesn't have $1 billion net worth, but they're worth a couple million dollars, or maybe they sold a business and they've got $30, $50 million, they should still be able to have the same support as $1 billion family office. And it helps them give back to communities that they want to support. It helps them invest better. It helps their family dynamic better to have a system in place. And so when I founded Alternative Wealth Partners, it was really focused on how can I provide this part of family office services, which is like the alternative investment piece, that allows a portion of people's portfolio to grow in a way that the traditional portfolio is never going to do. And so that's really my why. I wanted to give them transparency and access that they weren't getting.
And at that, at the end of the day, I think it's providing something that otherwise might not be there. I mean, I think that's what it kind of like impact to me is. And all of this, like, how do you define impact?
Impact is changing something that you can tangibly touch, I think, in your community and the way that you feel about it. The way that we make impact for our investors is that we give them access to stuff that will help them grow generational wealth beyond what their financial advisor can and will do for them.
I'm going to key on this word tangibly touch. What makes you say tangibly? Why can't it be intangible?
I think that even if it touches your soul, that it's still tangible. You're getting a feeling you are physically feeling. It feels good to do good. And I think that that's tangible.
I like that. I like that. Kelly, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today. I learned a lot about impact, your perspectives, the change you're making with your investments. And of course, we talked a little bit about Farsight leadership, right? Kind of the different approach that maybe a female manager or owner may have as opposed to the current status quo. And all of this, Kelly, what is your definition of a real leader?
I think a real leader is somebody that understands that growth and leadership is beyond yourself. Like, I think that as long as you are, as a leader, doing things that lift not only you, but also everyone around you up is the difference maker.
Well said for Kelly and Winjay. I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, think about being a leader that's greater than yourself. And always, folks, keep it real. Thanks, Kelly. Hey, ReLeaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to ReLeaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.